FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and thanks for joining us today. So today on the show, I'm going to be playing an archived episode from back in March of 2012, and apparently that week it snowed here in Vancouver. So if you hear some mention of the snow, it hasn't snowed now in the present, but it did snow back then in 2012. So I hope that you enjoy it. It's a discussion with Karuna Caton, and it's about his book, The Misleading Mind. So I hope you have a wonderful week. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste. Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with me today. And I hope that you're having a wonderful start to your week. Hope that wherever you are listening from, that you're cozy and warm and safe right now. So today we are speaking with Karuna Caton. He is the author of The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. And Karuna has worked as a psychotherapist, a business psychologist, and a coach to help people achieve a more balanced life. And he also lived in Nepal for 12 years, where he studied Tibetan Buddhism and taught Tibetan refugees. So welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Nice to connect with you.
Thanks for being on the show. So it's really exciting to have you on. And now, so this whole, we create our own problems. I mean, as when you're on the spiritual path, you kind of have a level of acceptance that there's responsibility for what you bring into your life. And at the same time, it can be a little bit difficult to agree with that. Like today, the fact, I mean, I was on my way here and I'm like, well, did I create this inconvenient snow?
Yeah. Well, if you did, you created it for everybody else.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Right.
Yeah.
So at what, I mean, what level of responsibility do we have to take? I mean, just for small things or big things too?
I think it's a great question. I think that it's easy to say that we are accountable. I mean, fundamentally, we're accountable for our reactions and the way we experience the data that comes at us. Often I talk with people and I say, okay, look at, you know, what happens is on one level, it's just data. It's just atoms coming at you, you know, if you really just sort of deconstruct what's happening, it hasn't any side of good or bad or aggravating or annoying or pleasurable from its side. So, you know, if we really begin to deconstruct and analyze how things really operate from their side, objects are more or less neutral. And so what we do have accountability for is the way we interact and relate and the effects they have on us, particularly from the point of view of our internal world. So, you know, there's a great debate. The debate gets very subtle as to where does our internal world stop and the external world begin. And that's a fun debate to have later down the road. But at the moment, we can just say we are accountable for our reactions and our experience of what we're experiencing.
All right, Karuna. Well, I have a question now. I've been talking about this. A couple weeks ago, I was on the show talking about how great my boyfriend was.
Right.
And I worked really hard using all my skills in psychology and spirituality and everything to be effective and non-judgmental and handle everything really well. And turns out he'd been lying to me and leading me on and dumped me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, obviously I need to take responsibility for how I'm going to, handle the situation, how I'm going to react. But also, I mean, I accept, you know, if we're not compatible, that's fine. But I mean, does that mean that I did something to create this?
Well, you're diving in quite, you know, you're forcing me into being more disclosing more about my thinking, which is that, you know, as we get more and more subtle, as we analyze the mind and our experience, you know, it's very hard to separate your entire experience that you just had with your boyfriend from your own internal images and projections that happened. So it's as one gets more subtle, then you see that you know, if you experience a result, right, then only you can have created the cause. So even the result of having your boyfriend show up in front of you in the way he did, or by lying and deceit and whatnot, it is, and this gets really, really hard, and it gets very debatable, I guess you could say, is you can't experience results and effects if you didn't create the causes. So it doesn't mean necessarily that, if people always go to these extremes, well, so you mean I created this tsunami? And my responses to those things is that, well, I created the war in Afghanistan, is that where your mind's experience stops, that part you did not create. But if you think about the whole experience with your boyfriend, if you can tell me what part of it wasn't generated and experienced by your mind, then that's the part that you did not create.
Oh, so, yeah,
so
I mean,
the very bottom line is we have these mental imprints, and when those imprints arise and ripen, then we have the experiences. We see the things we see, we hear the things we hear, we feel the things we feel.
And so then it brings me a question, as far as us having control over being able to accept that we are creating our problems and in order to solve them. Now, it comes to the question, and this could be true for any situation. It's just this is so fresh, so I'm going to use it as an example. Isn't it possible that this guy would have been wonderful and honest and loving with anyone, some other woman, but for me,
yeah,
it could have been just created by whatever internal drama I have, too.
Right. So, you know, the fact that he lied, you know, he lied to you, you had the experience of him lying, that you're exactly right. So, someone else could have had a different, or would have had a different relationship, we could say, with him. And so my question is, why? Why did they have experienced different results than you? So, there's something, you know, we believe that all problems arise from causes. It's not, there's no randomness. And if they arise from causes, we really have to analyze and investigate what those kinds of causes are. So that gets into the more of the spiritual, but it's also psychological realm. You know, if we plant an apple seed, you can't expect a plum tree. And in the same way, if you get lied to, and that's your experience, then you created those, somehow you created those imprints through your previous actions. So about being happy and having a good life, it's really about taking control of our causes right now in order to create the future that we really prefer to have.
So from a Buddhist perspective and from a perspective of your book, what kind of steps would you recommend someone taking if they, like as I had said, I did everything in the most effective way that I knew how.
Right.
I mean, I was even looking at any little problem that arose and comparing how I would have reacted 6 months ago, 2 years ago. And it was completely, I mean, oh my gosh, I was stellar in how I handled
Great.
It and
Great.
So proud of myself. And I still am. I mean, obviously it was a good experience as far as practicing using the skills that I've developed. But even if I did everything more effectively, obviously energetically, there's still something amiss. So how would you get to the root of when your behavior is not what seems to be causing it? It's at an energetic level. Where do you get to that root?
Well, that's good. Again, you know, the experience you had with your boyfriend from your side, you didn't. Okay, this just gets really kind of it gets more subtle. Is that you didn't? If he lies to you today, those imprints that you created, you know, they were not necessarily created in your relationship with him in the last year or however long you were together. So this is where it's kind of like I often tell people that just like we have physical DNA, I think we have mental DNA. So we separate the mental, there's only two realms of experience in this level. You know, one is the sort of physical form level, one is the mental level, which is not form. So your mental DNA was, you know, somehow you had in your mental DNA these imprints about, you know, him lying to you and so on. So there's only two things we can do. One is to deal with what's happening now. And it sounds like you used your tools and your skills and you continue to develop those tools and skills in order to go through those experiences in the best way possible. And then as we move along, then you're also thinking today, you know, what imprints are you creating today? Because we create countless gazillions of them every moment. What imprints are you creating now? And those will ripen in the future sometime. So we just say, you know, those imprints which are sort of ethically based or are non-harmful, those create, you know, you're going to have a good experience in the future. Those imprints ripen as positive experiences. And if you do nasty and mean things, and those imprints arise as nasty, mean things happening in your life later on. So that's the Reader's Digest version.
But then, okay, so, and I think I already know what you're going to say about this. I'm controlling the behavior, but yeah. I got to say that there are some nasty, mean thoughts that come up that I'm very proud of myself for not acting on, but I have to wonder what I'm projecting into my future with those thoughts.
Well, thoughts and behavior, I mean, it's good because thoughts, again, are mental imprints, but if we don't act on those thoughts, then those mental imprints have less energy behind them. So, they, you know, just having the thoughts, like, I really want to kill this guy, you know, is, you know, okay, that's probably, that's some sort of mental imprint.
Oh, I don't want to kill him.
You know,
I want
a morning
him to have
of depression
a long life.
For you at some point. But actually going out and then following those that behavior, then those mental imprints are magnified many, you know, thousands of times. So just stopping the behavior is a good thing.
Okay.
Ultimately, the best thing is to be able to also stop and have alternative thoughts.
Yes. Right. Okay. So how now we can get into training the mind, which is one of the chapters in your book.
Yes.
Are we ready to talk about some tips on how you can
sure.
do that?
Sure. Is that the question?
Yes.
You know, sorry. You know, this whole idea of Buddhist psychology, and I really, you know, I'm really trying to impress in the book that I want people to understand that these are universal principles. These are not, you know, the word Buddhist is a Sanskrit word. So if we took away the word Buddhist and said this is awakening principles, awakening, you know, because Buddha actually translates more as the Buddha is awake, means awaken. So a Buddhist is someone who's awakening or seeking to awaken. And so when I think about seeking to awaken, what I'm really trying to, again, impress in the book is this is awakening to sort of a state of mental health as opposed to the state that we're typically in. So the first thing that we need to, the tips are really centered around the fact that, you know, things are not perfect. We're almost at the whim of our emotions and under the control of whatever happens to us, as much as we might think we're in control. We're really not, at least in the inner world. And so, you know, the first thing is to recognize that we want to be happy. Every being really does, just in a simple level, wants to be happy. And but we don't know really what causes that happiness. So the first step, the first tip, is to really become familiar with how the mind is so out of control. It's so flaky. It's like a feather in the wind. And because of that, we go from problem to pleasure, from problem to, we don't have really any control. So that's the first tip I would give people, is become familiar with your mind, that you have a mind. And I think this is actually quite phenomenal that I often say we can describe what our hand looks like, but if you ask people, what is the mind? You know, people actually, even psychologists, don't have a very clear working definition. So the first thing is become aware that we have to train the mind, because the mind's untrained, and that is what makes us unhappy. The second step in that is, okay, the first, as many people know, I mean, the foundation of developing a trained mind is developing a mind that's more focused than what we got going now. And for that, there's lots of different focusing exercises, but the one we use mostly is focusing on the breath. And then there's a, you know, sort of formula to do that in the book of, I can go into details if you want, but that's the next thing on train. You can't train the mind if the mind's not at least at some level of focus and pliability. So those are the two first steps.
So it's interesting, Karuna. You said that we're not really in control, of our experiences, even though we have the illusion of control. But then, how can you also say that we create our own problems if we're not in control?
That is the creating of our own problems.
Is the lack of control.
Know, in the sense when you're, yeah, that is actually it. Because, you know, in a sense, you know, you're right. You could say I don't create my own problems, but my mind creates my problems because I don't have control over it. But in a sense, you know, we're the only ones that can control our minds. So it's around, you know, making a decision that we will go there. And, you know, I think in the book there's a story I tell about an early part about I was driving my own teacher in a car to kind of go to my new office to consecrate the office. And he out of the blue said, you know, if you're just helping people feel better, there's not really much benefit. And I think that that was such a profound experience for me. Because I think as a psychotherapist and as a psychologist, really all I was doing was trying to help people feel better. And in this approach of the Buddhist psychology, it's really around being better in the long term. So we might not actually feel better in the moment. It's not easy to look at our stuff. It's not easy to sit with a really disturbing emotion of being lied to and abandoned by or betrayed by a boyfriend. You know, that's not easy. But if you just try to feel better, that's not going to get rid of the problem. So I think that's how I mean that we are responsible and we are accountable. No one else can do it for us.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that on a certain level, we don't have control because we don't have control over our minds. But right. The fact that we don't have control of our minds is a choice. We can take the steps and discipline ourselves and have a larger level of control if we make that commitment.
Correct. And to be fair, you know, honestly, it's so amazing because we're not, as kids, we're not educated in this kind of thinking. So in a way, we are sort of victims because we don't know any better. But, you know, I'm not going to really use that as an excuse, I guess. But there's a lot of factors involved as to why we don't know this sort of simple truth. Why we don't know. We're not brought up with that. We're not trained in that. That's for many, many reasons. So in a sense, we're not to blame for not knowing. But in a sense, it's like free choice. People often ask, do we have free choice? Don't have free choice. And the answer is, well, we have it, but we don't use it. So in that sense, we don't have it. So it's just like that with training the mind and our own happiness. It's in our own hands.
And it sounds like all of us can blame our parents for screwing us up.
Yeah.
Every parent screws up their kids. But at a certain point, you've got to start taking responsibility and say, okay, yeah, they screwed me up. That's life. And now I still have responsibility for my own life.
Right. You know, exactly. And you know, there's many conditions. One of the things that's quite important, and I get myself a little bit of trouble sometimes, I don't explain that there are conditions and there are causes. And when I was talking about the mental imprints, I'm talking about the mental imprints that are generated or stored within our consciousness as the cause. Those are the actual causes for problems. Excuse me. And then the people in traditionally in psychology and probably just in normal life, we equate causes with conditions. So the fact that our parents were abusive or unloving or whatever they were, those now we consider those as conditions. Whereas normal psychology or normal conversation, we would say those are the causes of my problems. So that's it's really important. We do accept that conditions can be really bad, and we should have empathy for people and compassion in those conditions. But the causes are generated by each individual. And it sounds really brutal and rough and uncaring, but it's really not. So we do have acceptance of causes and conditions.
Well, and I have to agree with you on a certain level, because if you look at siblings or even twins, oftentimes they could come from completely the same household and have had a very, very similar experience growing up, and yet they both choose different paths in life, and one chooses a healthy, happy path and another may be miserable throughout their life.
Right.
Yet they had
Why
a very similar.
Happy?
Yeah, exactly.
I actually had that discussion or debate with a colleague of mine many years ago when I was working at MRI, Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto. And I asked him the exact same question, you know, and he was a social constructivist, so that everything was just socially constructed. And I said, but, you know, theoretically, these two kids have the same experience in their lives, the same social interactions, you know, and yet they grow completely different. I said, why is that? And he said, well, it's random. And I laughed out loud. It was just an automatic response. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, amongst our Buddhist community living in Nepal amongst Tibetans, debate is a very, very rigorous and robust way of getting and understanding the truth from an intellectual point of view. So I was all ready for a debate with this gentleman, and yet in the West, we don't really debate that much. And he took my questioning as kind of, I think he felt a little challenged and I was being a little rude, because when he said it's random, I turned to the door. There was a door next to me. And I said, so what you're saying is this doorknob could just suddenly become a flower? And he said, I think because he was backed into a corner, he said, yes. And that was kind of the end of my time at MRI, because we just don't believe that without a cause, you can experience the result. So nothing's random. We may not understand it, but nothing is random.
All right. Well, it is time for a break. So already a fascinating discussion. We are speaking right now with Karuna Caton. He is the author of The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. And what's your website, Karuna?
It's www.karunagroup.com. And you can reach me through there. We're in a process of revamping it. So there's something up, but it's not the full site redone yet. But that'll be in a few days.
Awesome. All right. So we'll be back with more synchronicity in a flash.
To hear extended interviews and behind-the-scenes chat, go to my website, mariebenard.com, and sign up for my mailing list, mariebenard.com. Thanks for listening.
The Crane Library is looking for student volunteers to record textbooks for those who cannot use print at the university. If you are a UBC student who is computer literate with an ability to read university material aloud and you have a willingness to learn new techniques, we ask for a 2-hour commitment once a week. For additional information and to set up an audition, call 604-822-6114 or email crane.volunteer@ubc.ca.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might also be listening online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And thank you wherever in the universe that you may be listening from, because radio waves are all over the place. So maybe you're even listening from another planet. I don't know. Who knows, right? Okay, so now I'm getting all, I haven't had much sleep, so I'm getting a little bit nutty here. So anyway, we're talking today with Karuna Caton, and he is the author of The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. Welcome back to the show, Karuna.
Thank you.
So we were talking about, you had mentioned that if you're just out to help people or help people feel better, you're not really making that much difference in the world. And it's really all about inner change and the process of growth, not just distraction or feeling better. And I'm looking at something in your book here, Practicing Honesty Without Guilt. Tell us more about that.
I'm not sure what I... Can you say the sentence after that?
When I was first introduced to these ideas and began investigating my own mind through introspection, I felt that the disturbing emotion of anger was not really all that present in my own mind stream. I had always prided myself on being someone who was not an angry person, and I suppose on a relative level, that was somewhat true. I had other afflictions that I knew I struggled with, but anger did not really present itself as a problem for me.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Honesty without it. That's a really a little tricky, difficult thing for us. I think what's referred to here is if we're really intent on being a spiritual person or a healthy person, because they're the same thing for me, mentally healthy and mentally balanced, my belief is that the only way you can really do that is to open ourselves up to all the little things and difficult corners of our psyche. You know, our emotions, our disturbing emotions, our positive emotions, our difficult interactions and what arises within our minds and our emotions. And so to do that, a lot of times what happens in the beginning is people, including myself, you get sort of overwhelmed, like, God, I am so messed up. And I didn't realize I was this neurotic. I didn't realize I was this disturbed. And one can develop a sense of guilt or indulgence, maybe. And this is what we really need to be careful, because if we open up to the intricacies of the mind and emotions, which is so vast and so mysterious and so unknown to most of us, we have to do it in a way that has some level of detachment. We have to do it as a sort of an archaeologist that's just digging up these bones and studying them and being curious and somewhat detached. So that's a very, very difficult thing. But if you know it ahead of time and you go into it, and you're going into a movie and you're open to whether it's a bad movie or a good movie, and that's a scary movie or a love story, you're just going in and all of whatever shows up, maintaining that curiosity and being as careful as possible not to get hooked by what things will arise, and that's one of the things that's feeling guilty. You have to really be more curious and detached. It's tough, but that's how we have to do it.
That's interesting, Karuna, because in this relationship, like I had said, I had been so effective, and I'd been very aware of my own thoughts and feelings.
Right.
So much so, I was so hyper-vigilant about checking in on my own issues that, you know, I would have these urges to bail and run away and whatever, and I had even talked about it on the show, like, you know, I'm wondering, I'm having these uncomfortable feelings, and I think maybe because there's no drama and I'm so used to drama, this is where it's coming from. But what I neglected to do was to take a step back further and look at the fact that it wasn't just me and my own internal issues. There's two people in any relationship, or at least two people.
Right.
And I think that the discomfort and the urge to run away actually wasn't coming from my childhood issues. It was coming from the fact that I was intuitively picking up on the fact that his words were not matching the energy.
Right.
And so even though I wasn't outwardly able to see any drama, there was actually drama brewing under the surface. And it was my intuition telling me to run away, not my childhood issues. So how do you, I'm wondering if it's one of those, like the pendulum swings in the other direction because you're trying to overcompensate for the past mistakes. So how do you find that balance where you're aware of your own stuff and you're also still able to take a step back and almost, because you had said the guilt, it's almost like self-indulgent of me to assume that every problem is caused just by me.
Yeah. I mean, if we had the right context, actually, I'd be more interviewing you around that, because I'm actually very curious how you think the differences between what is, you know, I call kind of intuition or wisdom versus what's just, you know, our emotional crap disguising itself as wisdom. But I won't put you in that corner at the moment. But I think that that's where the question goes. You know, that's the kind of curiosity I would like to promote with people, is for you to go in and sort of sit with both of those qualities, because you may find this quality of yours that you are intuitive and wise, and when that is authentic and when it is when your sort of afflicted minds are masquerading as your intuition, tricking you into having doubts and things like that. One thing I will say is that the difference between sort of a disturbing emotion and something else like wisdom or compassion, because we have all kinds of mental emotions, is the word we use in the book, but really it's more than just emotion. We're really talking about, you know, mindsets, you could say, or mental qualities. So there's mental qualities that are also positive, like empathy and compassion and wisdom and forgiveness and generosity, things like that. The one thing that maybe you can key into is when you're experiencing the emotion, like if you could have keyed into those thoughts that were telling you, those voices that were telling you about maybe you should, you know, whatever, be more cautious in this relationship, whatever it is. One way to just, as we get better at this, if it's your wisdom that's arising, that quality is not going to be disturbing. if it's the afflicted mind, you know, attachment and fear, the mind, it's really, it's almost, it's something that's going to actually be disturbing for the mind, disturbing for the mind as it is on its own. Wisdom and compassion may be brutal, and they may be very honest, and maybe even scary, but the quality of them is that they have an effect that they don't really disturb the mind. What disturbs the mind are the negative emotions, so attachment in particular. So if your attachment wasn't arising at that time, you probably could have just looked objectively at these voices or listened to them and probably would have had a key in on whether they were wisdom or arising from, you know, your past history and hurts. So it's really a different quality of mind. That's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like,
it takes some practice.
Yeah, I agree. And I think in my situation, what happened is that I had the feelings, and rather than sit with them and look at exactly why these emotions were coming up, I just automatically assumed, because he on the surface had the appearance that he had his self together pretty well. So yeah. I was like, well, it must be me. That's the only logical explanation. So I don't need to look into this further. I just need to manage my behavior around it. And I handled my behavior effectively, because I don't think running away in the middle of the night is appropriate ever. Well, unless you're in danger. But rather than handling the behavior, and then maybe when I felt a little more calm, sitting with that and really taking some time to be present around those thoughts and emotions, I just brushed them off as I've got issues.
Right. All of that has to go. All of those judgments at that time, you know, when we're actually in the process of doing self-therapy, really is what it is, we have to be aware of all the voices and all the dynamics, and not get, the trick is not actually getting stuck on any of them, but it's being mindful of them and aware of them. But it's also really, you know, there's a lot in the movement of mindfulness is a very big thing right now, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know, but it's pretty big, the whole mindfulness movement, I would say. And, you know, there's some things missing from that movement that it arises from the Buddhist tradition, but primarily mindfulness practice. But how it's morphing into sort of modern culture today, it's left out a few important parts of the traditional practice of mindfulness. One of the parts that's being left behind is what we call discernment. So it's not that we're just aware of our thoughts and feelings and emotions that arise. And I try to push this a little bit in the book. I'll push it more later in the future. But is that once it is being about being aware, so you could have been aware of the voices and the feelings, the fears, the doubts that were arising, but that's not enough. The next thing that has to happen is we have to sort of be discerning whether they're, where they arise from, what are they helpful or harmful, are they smart or are they stupid? You know, there's different ways of discerning the quality of those thoughts. So that's all you need to add to it. So once you get the mind quiet, and if you could have just looked and watched all that's arising, then it's also being discerning whether they're helpful or harmful. That's good enough.
And thank you.
Then some of your wisdom would have arisen, had a chance to rise.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. And I do try to, when I experience something that's unpleasant, I try to remind myself that everything happens for a reason. That's sort of a belief that I have just chosen to believe. And so from this experience, even though it has been gut-wrenching, perhaps it was there to teach me the lesson of discernment and take me one step closer to having that skill.
Yes, if you use it that way, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's no mistakes if we learn. If you don't learn from it, then we could say there's a mistake, because then you'll probably do it again.
Yes. Well, so then how have people, so many times, I mean, there are experiences that people have had that maybe they're carrying around for 20 years, or, you know, blaming their parents for stuff that, how they screwed them up or whatever. And now just because you've spent the last 20 years not learning any lesson from it, would you agree, and if you do, how do you do this? How do you turn that thing from 20 years ago into a learning experience now in the present?
That's a good question. I think that there's maybe a couple of different ways to answer that. I think what one way to look at that is in terms of the recent research and development in neuroscience, right, in neuroplasticity. I know it sounds like kind of a weird answer for what you just asked, but my point is that, you know, when we have an event, you know, it's a trauma or some sort of negative event, and especially that event is sort of registered and the imprints are made within our mind stream. And at the same time, there is the more we create a certain, well, whatever kind of thinking we have, that thinking becomes a habit. And it even becomes a physical manifestation through the neural pathways that get etched within on our brains themselves. So I've thought a lot about this. My own idea around what you just asked is that I think with enough proper mind training and contemplation and reflection, you can make a change in, you know, you can change your the wounds you have from that experience. But on a physical level, also, if we're contemplating mind and training the mind and visualize whatever it is you do or thinking about or talking about things, you have to be able to talk, think, reflect on things that are opposite to that habitual pattern that you've had for 20 years. So that will begin to rewire the brain on a very physical level. That's what happens. And that rewiring of the brain eventually allows us to kind of close the loop on that old wound that has created its own neural pathways. There's the work of Dr. Dan Siegel, for example. He says, you know, basically, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. Or he says also, if you use it, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? And so if you don't use that habitual way of thinking, whether it's thinking, feeling, visualizing, eventually it'll die. And you can, but then same, if you replace it with an alternative way of thinking, then you become actually you heal the mind in that way. So I hope that kind of explains it. I'm not sure how clear I was with that, but it's really around generating a different kind of thinking and feeling and visualizing. So I don't think you can change the past, but you can close the past and you can create a new future.
And you can create change your perception of the past.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so,
Go ahead. I think that, I would just say real quick, I think that's why they're finding research, for example, forgiveness is such a powerful healing component of past traumas, because I think that's sort of an opposite way of thinking about, you know, it's sort of rather than being caught in the loop of being a victim, you know, forgiveness offers a completely different paradigm, and you know, people aren't often ready for it, but that is why I believe forgiveness is so often healing.
Beautifully said. And I totally love forgiveness, and it's really for yourself more than the other person. But now let's talk about, there's a couple of different trains of thought that I'm having here about the discussion we're having. So I'm just going to throw one of them out there. As far as changing your perceptions and the neuroplasticity and all of that. Now this takes work. It's a gradual process. So what do you do for the person that gets really frustrated? I mean, even for myself, like I see how I've been taking steps to make positive change in my life for, I don't know, decades. And it's sort of, I mean, it gets to a point where there's a certain level where your growth actually becomes exponential. But before that time, it's really slow and tedious and frustrating. And how do you keep perspective when you're in the middle of that place?
Yeah, it's really slow and tedious and frustrating. So we're not going to take that away. It is that. It gets like that sometimes for everybody. There's many factors that help us. One of the factors that helps is really getting in tune with what our intentions are, our motivation itself. This is a big one, and we don't really talk about this much in any sort of therapeutic realm or even self-help, you know, that much. But actually, intention or motivation is really everything. So if we enter this process so that I am happy now, so very short term, let's say, then, yeah, you know, that's probably going to be pretty level, a higher level of frustration and tediousness, and also you probably give up pretty soon. But if you have sort of a longer term, it's very important probably to have a long-term vision, which means of having a longer-term intention, which is that, you know, I know this is going to take a long time. I'm going to just get better and better, and it's going to be until the end of my life and maybe beyond, you know. So depending on who you are, if your intention is very big and long-term, the tediousness and frustration is a lot less. And I want to. Do I have time to tell a quick story here?
Oh yes, please do.
You know, some years ago, probably 10 years ago, I was at some teachings with the Holiness of the Dalai Lama, and these teachings for 3 days were about compassion and generating compassion and in your development and whatnot. And so at the end, he took some questions and answers, and the last question was, so how do we attain this awakening? What's the fastest way to attain it? And I thought that was a great question. I thought, you know, it was genuine, and it seemed to be a caring kind of a question. And His Holiness just stopped, and he paused. And then he got kind of wrathful and animated and says, you know, you Westerners, you're always looking for the quick fix. He interpreted the question completely different than I had. You're always looking for the quick fix. And then he told the story of a great saint in Tibet, a well-known saint called Milarepa. And Milarepa he killed 32 people, something like 36 people, and then, of course, entered the spiritual path, and his whole life was spent, you know, purifying, not just purifying that action, but he did purify that. And he lived in a cave high up in the Himalayas. If he's been up there, it's freezing. He just had this thin cloth that he wore around him, and he meditated constantly to generate very high levels of realization. And so Milarepa had a student, and his close student. And one day, the student had studied with Milarepa for many, many years. And finally, Milarepa says to him, well, now I think it's time for you to go out on your own. You know, there's nothing more I really have to teach you. You have to go help others. So tomorrow morning, you know, you'll leave, and I'll walk you part way. So, you know, which is a tradition. So as the morning came and they left, they were walking together for a few miles, and they came to a bridge. And then Milarepa said to him, okay, you know, this is where I need to leave you, and you're out on your own, you know, so, and kind of good luck. So as they separated, Gompopo, his name, the student, was going up the hill, and suddenly he panicked, and he thought, wait a minute, maybe I didn't learn everything from Milarepa. Maybe he held back from me. And so this is Holiness telling the story, and while this Holiness, the Dalai Lama, is telling the story, he's crying and crying and pausing, and tears are flowing, you know, as if he's right there watching the scene. And then finally, as Gompopo is climbing the hill, he thinks he has this panic thought, maybe I didn't learn everything. So he turned back and he yelled to Milarepa. He says, tell me, did you teach me everything? And he said, yes, you got it all. And then Gompopo said, well, what's the one thing? What's the most important TIF instruction? Just tell me, which of your thousands of teachings that you gave me is the most important? And Milarepa lifted up this thin cloth. He turned his back to him, wearing this thin, tiny cloth, and he revealed all these scars on his legs and on his butt and all these boils. And he said, this is the greatest teaching I have to give you. Practice. And then they walked off.
So
I don't know, as Westerners, sometimes this modern world, it's not about becoming happy or healthy next year, next month. It's about becoming happier. It's about the path of happiness. I don't know about the goal, you know, but just to get better year by year is good enough, really.
Well, and that's, I mean, in our society, we are so focused on the results and the goal, the end goal, that we really miss a lot of the journey.
Yeah.
And I think that it kind of brings to mind a lot of people, you know, the movie The Secret, which teaches the law of attraction, and it was very results oriented and also very commercially monetarily oriented. So people would watch and they go, okay, I'm going to make myself happy so I can attract this money or the new car. And of course that, I mean, sometimes you get results in you know, a short time, and then, but it isn't over the long term. It's not creating change in your life.
No.
And so it's almost a recipe for depression and disappointment.
It is. It's very sad, actually. I saw that movie. I mean, there's some science to it that's kind of interesting. But, you know, going back to the book and this, the idea here is really understanding what is happiness and what are its causes. And it gets into it. And it's not an external thing. You know, no matter if we get a new dynamic, like even what's created in The Secret, you know, the same old thing is going to keep up. If fundamentally, we believe that something out there is going to be a source of happiness, then we are going to be disappointed. And it doesn't mean if it's a new, you know, whatever new idea, even if it's so-called spiritual ideas, you know, it doesn't matter if the thinking behind it is fundamentally flawed. And it's by not craving that we become really happy, not by craving something new.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you for some tips on not craving after the break. We've got to take a break now, though. So this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. And right now we are speaking with Karuna Caton. He was for over 20 years. He's worked as a psychotherapist, a business psychologist, and a coach to help people achieve a more balanced life. And he also lived in Nepal for 12 years, where he studied Tibetan Buddhism. And you can find him at the Karuna Group. com. And this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we'll be back in a second.
To hear extended interviews and behind-the-scenes chat, go to my website, mariebenard.com, and sign up for my mailing list, mariebenard.com. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to sky-high gas prices, we can convince America that more drilling is the answer. High gas prices? Drill more. Prices still high? Try drilling in a wildlife refuge. You're off a nice beach.
Our traditional energy resources are limited. Luckily, it's easy for students like you to conserve energy.
Woke up late for class? Buy some time in the morning by taking a shorter shower. Cut down by 1 minute every day and save enough to fund your daily caffeine fix for over a week. Plus, you save on electricity and water. Install a water-saving showerhead to save even more.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
All right, welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. Coming up in just a few minutes is Parts Unknown, so stick around for that. Right now we're speaking with Karuna Caton. He's the author of The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. So how do we detach ourselves from the results and surrender a little bit?
Yeah. Well, also... to be clear, you know, sometimes people think in terms of Buddhism and Buddhist psychology, oh, they're all about giving up desire and you know, I got to go live in a cave or a monastery. And this is just one of those misconceptions. I mean, maybe for some people they do have to go live in a cave and a monastery. But just those of us who are living in the world, really to understand what we're talking about is just understanding how the mind works. And so when we... problems arise not from getting a new car, not from having a new boyfriend or girlfriend, not from getting a good house or having a family or a good job. That has nothing to do with it. What it has to do with is when we get attached to those things as the source of happiness. So the problem is attachment, stickiness, not the thing. It's not in the object. You know, sometimes, you know, we can't handle an object, so we don't drink or we don't get stoned or we don't go out and, you know, don't get new cars or whatever, because when I get a new car, I get really attached. I'm going to try and work on that differently by not having a new car around me. When I go into a bar, I know it's not the alcohol, but I can't help but drinking. So then you discipline your life. But the real problem is not even in the bar. The problem is in the attitude towards what I think drinking will give me or a new car. And we can attach and stuck to it to this thing that's actually very static and moving and doesn't exist the way it appears. So to get clear, you know, really what we're trying to do is just monitor, control the mind from getting stuck on things. So you can have good food and nice things. It's just don't get stuck on it. Don't think it's the source of happiness. So that's where we're heading, and that's what we're trying to do. And just becoming aware of that actually tempers the mind a lot. And that's the beginning stage of just controlling our craving, because if I think, you know, getting high is not going to make me happy, I'm not going to crave it as much. Slowly, over time, it'll dissipate.
And Karuna, though, at the same time, I mean, it almost sounds like we are fighting against our instincts. Because, I mean, the idea of attachment, I can see attachment to things. People have judgments about, oh, they shouldn't be so attached to money or whatever. But, I mean, we get attached to people. Oxytocin, yeah. The bonding hormone, yeah. It's part of, it's hardwired into us to create these bonds and attachments to people in our lives. And yet the whole idea of being attached to someone is what creates the pain when they go away.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's what we could think about. Are we talking about connection or are we talking about attachment? Because connection we will have. We are human beings. We're in relationship. We will be in relationship with a few people. That's what we do. And so it's about generating better relationships then. And also, if you look at how the mind works, you know, it's just a matter of, as we become more aware of how the mind functions, my mind gets really disturbed when I get really excited about, you know, getting a new car. And as we become more and more responsible and accountable for our own happiness, I say, oh, well, I'm really setting myself up. I don't really, you know, I can get a new car, but look what you're doing. I'm creating this fantasy. I'm getting agitated. I'm getting pissed off with the dealer who's not getting the model in that I wanted. All those things. And when it comes to other people, of course, we have attachments to our family and other people, and we will always have that. It's just a question of, remember I said, it's not about today and tomorrow, sad today, happy tomorrow, solution. It's about becoming aware of how we function in those relationships. And, you know, if we have kids and our level of attachment to them usually is there because I'm using my kids to make me happy. As you know, in terms of love and loving our children, the more we love, you see loving parents, it actually is more almost like they're more committed to their children's happiness than their own happiness. So that's not the kind of attachment I'm talking about. The opposite, the antidote to this kind of attachment is to think of others more than ourselves. And that's, again, a debatable subject that people go into about holding on codependency and things like that, which I won't go into here. But ultimately, this sense of self-centeredness is a problem for us. Other-centeredness is much better antidote and less disturbing to the mind.
All right, Karuna. Well, it has been a fascinating discussion with you. Your book is The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. So as we close the show, is there anything that you want to say that wasn't covered or how would you like to close the show?
Well, I just want to reiterate that this book is the ideas around this cover the universal principles of Buddhist psychology and Buddhist philosophy. You don't have to be Buddhist. You don't have to be anything. You just have to want to be happier and be willing to look at the mind as a source of unhappiness and the mind as a source of happiness. So that's probably all I can say without saying a whole lot more.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Karuna. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Take care. So again, that was Karuna Katen, and he is the author of The Misleading Mind, How We Create Our Own Problems and How Buddhist Psychology Can Help Us Solve Them. And today we were talking about, you know, how it is a journey and it can get really frustrating when we keep making these, I'm using air quotes, mistakes and judging ourselves and all of that. And, you know, I think what I'd like to leave you with today is just a reminder that none of us is perfect. And if you are struggling right now, I'd like you to take a moment and look back on where you were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, even 2 years ago, and see how you've changed. Even though maybe you're not where you want to be right now in your life, take a moment and really give yourself credit for how much you have grown and all of the amazing steps that you have taken. And forgive yourself for those slip-ups, because not only are they just part of life, but they're also can be great learning opportunities if we choose to perceive them in that way. So I want to open my heart wide to you and send you lots of love. And because, you know, the more love that you send out, the more love you get back. So sending my love to you. I hope you have a fabulous week. And in just a moment is Parts Unknown. Be well. Love you so much. Namaste.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
Reaching out for help is a sign of strength, not weakness. Wednesday, January 25th, get involved with UBC Suicide Awareness Day. Find out what you can do to help prevent suicide and to combat the stigma surrounding it. Spread the word and show the world that no one is ever alone by wearing orange to raise awareness. For more information about suicide awareness or for help if you or someone you know is considering suicide, visit thrive.ubc.ca.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities.
They are doing this by developing gender-affirming, client-centered models of service,
ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available,
and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support.
Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for the trans members of our community.
You've got a kind and gentle way that I'll remember for all of my days, and a quiet pride that keeps you moving. But it's been a while since you came a calling, and the weight of my love couldn't keep you here. My love can hold.